the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J. M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the Bible of the collector car hobby, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is Peter Burley.
Coming up on this week's Environment Show, subsidies to help loggers cut trees in national forests have been reduced, and timber interests are being told that corporate welfare is coming to an end. Maggots eat antheads from the inside out as scientists try to reduce the population of exotic South American fire ants in the southeast. Author Howard Mosier meets a wolf in the woods of Minnesota. And in the Earth calendar, thunderstorms of fire rage through the western forests. These stories and more coming up on this week's Environment Show. For years, environmental activists have been lobbying Congress to eliminate taxpayer subsidies that damage natural resources. Their most notorious target has been the provisions in the federal budget which finance road building in national forests. The roads penetrate wilderness areas, cause mudslides, and cost so much that the government loses money on the timber sales. Republican Congressman from Illinois John Porter and Democrat from Massachusetts Joseph Kennedy tried to eliminate the subsidy this year with an amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill. A substitute offered by Norm Dix from Washington to keep the program going at a reduced rate passed by two votes instead. Despite this, Congressman Porter thinks a lot was gained this year.
Well, I don't think it failed. We did not get the amendment to eliminate the program entirely. That's true. And a substitute was adopted by two votes, 211 to 209, that would have reduced, it did reduce our cuts about in half. But that was the first time that we have ever been able to cut the program. And I think the message on such a close vote was to the timber interests that the days of a timber road subsidy are numbered.
While many environmentalists are disappointed that the subsidy was not eliminated entirely, Jim Johns, former congressman and director of the Ancient Forest Campaign, is upbeat.
The Dix Amendment cut half of the purchaser credit program, which is the barter system under which roads are built, where we give trees to timber purchasers, plus a significant part of the funds going for roads that are built with direct appropriations. So, in fact, more than half of the roads that are proposed for the coming year were defunded by this amendment. The purchaser credit system is the way that most of the new timber roads are built in the Forest Service. It's a barter system that the timber companies like, and by cutting half of the purchaser credit, we won a very big victory.
Some environmental activists say that the Porter-Kennedy amendment to eliminate the subsidy would have passed were it not for a confusing letter from Dan Glickman, the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, which was circulated just before the vote. What Glickman actually wrote was that the administration opposes the purchaser road credit program, but it wants to see states and counties reimbursed if they lose timber sale revenues. It also opposed total elimination of the road subsidy appropriation because it wants money to repair some existing roads, although it favors reduction of new road construction. The whole fight now moves to the appropriation process in the Senate, and while elimination of the road subsidy seems unlikely this year, it appears that political support to keep it going in the future is eroding significantly. Congressman John Kasich, chairman of the House Budget Committee, also sponsored the Porter-Kennedy Amendment. He brought the clout of the budget cutters and the fiscal conservatives with him. Marty Hayden, senior policy analyst with the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund, who lobbied to get rid of the subsidy, notes that for the first time, manufacturers of sporting goods and sports writers are also involved.
With enough roads to go 14 times around the world, I think we have no lack of access in our national forests with these roads. There were actually a number of sports writers, hunter and angler writers, who, if for all practical purposes, editorialized in support of this because they see that this sort of overconstruction of logging roads in our national forest that has gone on is actually hurting the recreation resource rather than helping it. And that's also why the Sporting Goods Manufacturers Association supported the Porter Kennedy Amendment this year as well. And from a scientific perspective, it is not a it is not new news that these logging roads are some of the most detrimental activities the Forest Service does. Basically, the National Marine Fisheries Service has gone on record saying that this road construction has been the primary cause of salmon habitat decline.
Looking ahead, Congressman Porter says that times have changed, and subsidies for the logging industry, whereby the taxpayers pay for the roads to allow the cutting of our national forests to support below-cost timber sales, will come to an end in the foreseeable future.
We have reformed the welfare system in our country and sent a very clear message that people who are able-bodied have to seek work, that you cannot permanently remain on public support. We have, in the last Congress, begun the process of reforming our agriculture subsidies, and we've said that over a period of years we will gradually whittle away those agricultural subsidies and eliminate them. We are now saying to corporate interests who have received public help for a long, long time that your days are numbered, that these programs have to be reformed as well.
That was Congressman John Porter from Illinois. I'm Peter Burley, and the Environment Show wants to hear from you. Call our toll-free reaction line at 1-888-49-GREEN, or call to join a future on-air discussion. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Leave a question or a message, and we'll get back to you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You can visit us on the Internet, where you can hear The Environment Show anytime at www.enn.com/envshow. While movie stars fight space invaders this summer, scientists are fighting plant and animal invaders right here on Earth. So-called exotic or invasive species have become major problems. In many cases, chemicals are either too expensive or too dangerous to use. So scientists are turning to nature's own regulatory system. The field is called biological control, and it aims to use an invasive species' natural enemy to cut back or eliminate the population. The Environment Show's Thomas Lally takes a good look at this fast-growing field.
The fire ants have taken over your front yard. They've tormented your family, killed your neighbor's cat, and destroyed your garden. Nothing seems to get rid of them. Until now. Enter the forid fly.
It has the very unusual life habit of attacking the fire ant workers and injecting an egg into the body. And the egg hatches and within a few days moves into the head of the ant. And it sort of floats around in the head of the ant for about 3 weeks, and the ant behaves normally with a slowly growing maggot in its head. And then all of a sudden one day the ant crumples to the side, and the maggot releases a bunch of enzymes that begin to dissolve everything in the head and the membranes that hold the body together. Within a few hours the head falls off, the maggot has eaten everything in the head out, the brain, the muscles, and then it begins pushing away the mouth parts. After it's pushed away the mouth parts, then it retracts back into the body and pupates inside the head. So it turns into a kind of like a chrysalis and uses the ant's head as a pupal case.
Sanford Porter is a research entomologist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Research Service in Gainesville, Florida. He studies the forid fly as part of a project to control the population of exotic South American fire ants, which today infest virtually the entire southeastern U.S. The flies are those ants' natural enemies, and in their home environment, thousands of miles away, they do a good job of keeping the ants' numbers in check.
Fire ant populations in South America are about one-fifth of what they are here in the U.S. So we have unusually high densities of fire ants in the United States. And the reason we think we have these high densities is because they've escaped almost all their natural enemies. There's literally dozens and dozens of natural enemies in South America, but almost nothing up here. And things like climate and soil don't seem to do a good job of explaining the differences between the U.S. and South America.
Dr. Porter's specialty is called biological control, or biocontrol. The idea is to use nature to take care of problem plants and animals. The big question with biocontrol is whether it makes sense to introduce another exotic species to control one that's already a pest. Dr. Porter says in this case the answer is yes. He says the forward fly fits the criteria scientists look for in biological control. They only attack one species and will starve to death before switching to another one. The forward fly will not eradicate the exotic fire ant, but it's hoped it will keep their numbers tolerable. Dr. Marshall Johnson is the chair of the entomology department at the University of Hawaii. He says biocontrol is nothing new, but technology has increased substantially.
Well, biological control began just through some techniques by the Chinese as long ago as, I think it was 3000 B.C., when they would put holes between citrus trees to get ants to go from one tree to another to feed on a pest of citrus. Modern biological control, as we know it, basically got started around 1875 to 1880, I believe it is. And this was with the introduction of the cottony cushion scale into California.
The cottony cushion scale is an insect which attacks citrus groves. At the time, Charles Valentine Riley, then head of entomology for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, sent an assistant to Australia to collect two enemies of the cottony cushion scale.
And they introduced these into Southern California, somewhere around Los Angeles, and within a year they got control of the cottony cushion scale. Now this is very significant because the cottony cushion scale is about ready to end the citrus industry in California, and it was just to them it was a miracle that they could get control, and at that point started the big biological control push in California.
And the science of biocontrol has gotten a lot better since those days, mostly because exotic species are spreading around the world like wildfire. Every time we move things, like people and goods, we risk unintentionally carrying animals and plants along with us. And when those animals and plants find themselves in a place with no natural enemies, sometimes their populations explode. That's what's happening in the northern tier of the U.S. A pretty flower called purple loosestrife is out of control in many wetlands. Gene Holler is a wildlife biologist at the Sherburn National Wildlife Refuge in central Minnesota, where thousands of acres are infested with purple loosestrife.
Purple loosestrife is a rapid invader. It comes in and really outcompetes the natural vegetation that are there, the different bulrushes and the cattail and things that provide good wildlife habitat to the wetland critters.
Although Holler would love to eradicate purple loosestrife, she says she'll be happy if the population is simply cut back. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has introduced a beetle from purple loosestrife's home in Europe, where the beetle, and not the plant, is considered the pest. Preliminary results have been favorable.
So the hope is just to get it so it's a manageable part of our wetland community here in North America as well, so that we see that the loosestrife is in places where we've had it out in the field. We see that there is some kind of shrinking back of the loosestrife. It reduces it in some places in the United States. It's reduced it, you know, up to maybe even 90% of what it formerly was.
Studies have shown that the beetle, like the forage fly, is so particular it will die before switching to another host. But some uses of biological control aren't so specific. In lakes and ponds across the country, Eurasian milfoil is a big problem. Mike White is with the company called the Lake and Watershed Management Group, based in Connecticut.
Well, Eurasian water milfoil is an exotic aquatic plant that was brought in from Europe, primarily in the aquarium trade or aquarium industry, and doesn't have any natural checks or balances here in the United States, and can very easily, very quickly dominate over native vegetation in a pond or even in very large lakes. So in a very short period of time, matter of 2 to 3 years, you can lose your entire, or very close to it, your entire natural plant community and end up with large monoculture stands of Eurasian water milfoil in a lake or pond.
Killing or controlling milfoil is a much less exact science than purple loosestrife or fire ants. Like those cases, chemicals work, but they're expensive and politically unpopular. So White and his company are licensed to use grass carp, a fish native to China and Russia. He says the fish take care of the milfoil all right.
So these fish are kind of vacuum cleaners for ponds. Is that an accurate way to describe them?
Yeah, exactly. One of their downfalls is that they do too good of a job.
So with the grass carp, you trade your infested pond for a denuded one. But White says milfoil is so bad, it's often better to start over than to try to control it. Introducing grass carp or any exotic species requires intense oversight from federal and state officials. They've been burned in the past. Kudzu, now infesting the southeast, was introduced to prevent erosion next to railroad tracks. And mongoose was introduced in Hawaii to control snakes. It wound up ignoring the snakes and killing off several species of birds. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
We all have places which are special to us. For some, they're city streets. For others, they're deep in the wilderness. Author Howard Frank Mosier celebrated his first half century of life by traversing America's northern border. He presents a portrait of an encounter with a wolf in Minnesota. It's chronicled in his book, North Country, A Personal Journey, published by Houghton Mifflin.
At 5:30 the next morning, I was paddling a canoe into the boundary waters north of Ely, following the same route that the Minnesota nature essayist and preservationist, Sigurd Olson, had taken hundreds of times. Before I'd gone a mile, an eagle came soaring out of the north, and with him a fresh dawn breeze and sunrise. The mist tattered apart, patches of blue sky appeared, and the eagle, his snowy head gleaming in the sunshine, wheeled 100 feet above the water, looking for a fish breakfast. By the time I entered the lake's outlet, there wasn't a cloud to be seen. The river water was amber-colored, stained by tannins leached out of the evergreen forest. It looked trouty, but I was searching for something else, a wolf or a deer kill left by a wolf, or even a wolf track. A nearby wooded ridge looked inviting. From its crest, a big gray, as timber wolves are called in northern Minnesota, their last wild bastion in the lower 48 states, could bask in the sun and keep tabs on a vast swath of territory. I had a compass and a pair of waterproof boots. Tramping up there to see what I could see was worth a shot. Why not? I nosed the canoe into a sedgy marsh, took a quick bearing, and struck off dead west toward the ridge. For the first few hundred yards, the footing was spongy. Soon I entered a band of spruce and fir trees draped with the gray-green hanging moss that deer love above all other food. Higher up the ridge, in a mixed woods of evergreens, maples, beech, and birch, I spotted the unmistakable two-pronged indentations of a small deer, probably a yearling, headed down toward the river. Nearby, I counted several varieties of ground cover, white caribou moss, springy green ground pine, and an ankle-deep, resilient, hemlock-colored moss I couldn't identify. Now I was scrambling around granite outcroppings, some pink, some silvery dark. The woods glistened, from an overnight shower, even the spider webs sparkled brightly. Getting out into the northern wilderness never fails to produce in me that exhilarating sense of well-being that I first experienced on my early fishing excursions with my father and uncle. And here in the tall Minnesota woods, I was excited to discover rose-colored bunch berries, the glossy blue-black berries of Clintonia, fiery red partridge berries, and, in a ridgetop clearing created by a forest fire years ago, blueberries as big around as the end of my thumb. The view in all four directions was a green and blue amalgam of rivers, lakes, ponds, islands, peninsulas, and dark wooded isthmuses. A mile to the north, I could see the Pigeon River, which forms the Canadian border in this part of Minnesota, but no trace of wolves yet. By now it was late afternoon, and I was eager to get on to International Falls. I had only a few more miles to go on the Echo Trail before leaving the boundary waters, and I was moving along at a fair clip, not hurrying, but driving purposefully toward my destination, when ahead, on the right shoulder of the woods road, the wolf simply seemed to materialize, long-legged and dark as night. It appeared so abruptly that I actually didn't have time to be surprised. As I skidded to a stop, it trotted into the woods, but instead of vanishing into the forest, it suddenly veered and ran back toward my car. No more than 20 feet away, it paused and looked straight at me for perhaps 10 seconds. No camera could have captured that wolf's wild expression, much less my own sense of excitement at this face-to-face encounter with the animal which, more than any other, was emblematic to me of the boundary waters. There it was, and there I was, entirely by chance. I'd gladly have driven all the way from Vermont to northern Minnesota for this experience, which meant everything to me and nothing at all to the wolf. Now, as suddenly as it had appeared, it faded away into the trees, leaving me alone on the woods road with as fine a memory of my day in the northern Minnesota wilderness as I could wish to possess.
Author Howard Frank Mosier from his book North Country, A Personal Journey, published by Houghton Mifflin. Stay tuned. The Earth Calendar is next. It's summer in North America, and while it's hazy and hot and humid in the east, it's fire season in the west. Edward Johnson is a professor and fire ecologist at the University of Calgary in Alberta, Canada. He says the right weather is moving in, so fires aren't too far behind.
But occasionally, these highs persist, and they're called blocking high-pressure systems at that point. And they persist for long periods of time, usually for weeks at a time, and it's under those sorts of conditions that one tends to get lots of fires because, as you can imagine, it's hot, dry, fuels dry out quite a bit. Then all you need is a source of ignition.
Johnson says fire seasons can be mild for years or even decades before a bad year. When that happens, fires can range over enormous swaths of land. While forest fires appear to human eyes as purely destructive, nature views them differently.
Particularly large fires are really essentially a heat source on the ground and then a big convective plume right above it. In other words, a big thunderstorm, so to speak, above it with a lot of up and down drafts in it. And those up and down drafts push the fire in different directions. And it appears that inside these big fires, there are areas that for some reason on the way the wind is going up or down, that it leaves areas that don't have any obvious characteristic of why they shouldn't have burned, except that the fact that they were, say, for example, in a strong downdraft area. Now, the only seeds that are going to come into the burn afterwards are going to come from the edge of the burn or from little pieces that survive inside that didn't burn. And so, consequently, the distance from the edge or from these burns, remnants, will influence what the density of seeds will be.
Johnson says some fires can't be managed. That's why toasting marshmallows on a campfire is a futile effort. Just burn them and see if they reseed before you stick them in your mouth. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, we remember Congressman Silvio Conti, whose last project was a new kind of wildlife refuge, and we meet the author of the first book about him. We talk green about elephants, ivory, and international trade. And the band Christopher reminds us that we all have a stake in protecting the Earth. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. From its source, a 2.5-acre beaver pond frequented by moose on the Quebec border of New Hampshire, to its mouth on the Long Island Sound in Connecticut, the 407-mile Connecticut River runs through four states, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, and Connecticut. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is in the process of setting up a federal wildlife refuge, which will encompass the whole river. This is a pioneering effort, since all other refuges are distinct pieces of real estate you can put a fence around. The Connecticut River Refuge, which is the first of its kind, will protect wildlife habitat through a combination of partnerships with state and local governments, agreements with landowners, as well as acquisition of land by federal and local governments and conservation organizations. It's called the Silvio Conti National Fish and Wildlife Refuge, named after Congressman Conti, or Silvio as he was known to his friends and constituents. He introduced legislation creating the refuge just before his death, in 1991. In his 31 years in Congress, from 1959 to 1991, Silvio had a huge impact on the environment. Peter J. Lynch, who knew the congressman, has just written a book about him called Silvio, Congressman for Everyone. One of the most memorable things Silvio did was to lead the fight against many of the Pork Barrel Dam projects at a time before the negative environmental impacts and the huge costs of the behemoths were recognized or understood. Sounding the pork barrel theme, Conti got people's attention when he put on a rubber mask of a pig's head before debating a bill. Author Lynch describes one of Silvio's early battles.
Early in his career, he was involved in fighting a hydroelectric project in northern Maine known as Dickey Lincoln, which began in 1965 and finally died in 1979.
And you have a great story in your book about his trip up there. Tell us about that.
Well, I got told this story by the late Speaker Tip O'Neill, who was Silvio's best friend in the Congress. This incident occurred right after the great Northeast power blackout in 1965. The general consensus was that New England and the Northeast had a shortage of electric power and they needed additional sources of energy, and there was a proposal way up in northern Maine to build a hydroelectric plant in the Allegash Wilderness. This plant, a stream would be dammed up, and the water would go over the dam in the daytime, and then at night it would be pumped back up. And Tip O'Neill said a whole delegation of congressmen from New England went up there, including Silvio Conti. And the project was explained to all the members of Congress, and they all thought, oh, this was going to be wonderful. In the middle of it, Silvio started screaming and waving his arms. This is a disaster. We're not going to do any of this. This ruins the last wilderness in New England. And he, from his position on the Appropriations Committee, fought this for 14 years to kill it.
It is said that the huge water projects never die. One of the most humongous proposals was the Garrison Diversion Project proposed for North Dakota. It would have cost millions and millions and had a huge negative environmental impact. Working with conservation organizations, Silvio helped to see that it was never built. I used to visit Silvio a lot during those battles in my capacity as president of the National Audubon Society. He cared about ducks and water and open land and wildlife throughout the United States. Lynch describes what motivated Silvio.
He got into it because he loved the outdoors. His views toward things were very basic and often emotional, and he'd go to some place and see some beautifully pristine area, and he would either want to improve it or preserve it and not let it just be subjected to unreined development or to some big pork barrel water or dam or dock or project like that. He, for years, worked on getting the Connecticut River, which ran through his district, cleaned up. He was a very basic environmentalist. In fact, he was an environmentalist long before that term ever came into being. He really started this interest in the state Senate, to which he was elected in Massachusetts in 1950.
But he was quite a fisherman and hunter as well.
Oh yeah, he hunted and fished all over the country. He used to go fishing in Alaska in August. That was one of the few vacations he would take. And if he visited another congressman's district, it was often to visit a project or some particular thing, and then they'd go hunting or fishing, whether it be in Virginia, Maryland, Alabama, or anywhere.
My recollection, when I used to see him in his office in Washington, was that he had more stuffed ducks and various heads of various things hanging around his office than you could see in a zoo.
Well, that was true. And one of the things he did for about 25 years, he sat on a committee with the Fish and Wildlife Service that every year they issued the hunting stamps, which he used to have framed all over his house, and he'd go to the annual issuance of these stamps. But the funds that were raised from this were used to buy wildlife refuges and to take land and put it into wildlife refuge sanctuary. And he sat on the committee at Fish and Wildlife that made the decision of what property they would buy. So he got to see a lot of places around the country and campaign to purchase these lands.
That was Peter E. Lynch, author of The Portrait of Congressman Conti, called Silvio, Congressman for Everywhere, just published by Sunstone Press. He's donating the proceeds of the book to the Education Foundation, which Conti established just before his death. From a personal point of view, I remember Silvio not only as a great protector of the outdoors, but an incredible politician in the best sense. A progressive Republican, he sometimes ran unopposed because he would win the Democratic primary through write-in votes. In an era when everyone is cynical about everybody in public life, Conti was a man who cared and was considered a friend by everyone he represented. He was a friend to his constituents, a friend to wildlife, and a friend to those places where wildlife lives. As Peter Lynch writes in his book, former House Speaker Tip O'Neill said if the Founding Fathers had a chance to pick a model congressman out of all the hundreds that have served, they would have picked Silvio Conti. We're Talking Green, and I'm your host, Peter Burley. Today we're talking about wildlife and international trade. The idea is that wildlife can be saved if the sale of certain wildlife products, like ivory, is prevented. This is done through the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, known as CITES. And recently, at the CITES meeting in Zimbabwe, the restrictions against the sale of ivory, such as elephant tusks, were loosened. Is restricting trade of wildlife products a good idea? What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And today I have two experts with me, both in Washington. One is Don Barry, and he is acting Assistant Secretary for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks of the United States Department of Interior, and he headed the U.S. delegation at the recent CITES conference. Also with us is Jeanette Hemley, and she's the Director of International Wildlife Policy at the World Wildlife Fund, and that's an international conservation organization. Don Barry from the Department of Interior, let's start with you. At the CITES conference, the United States did not want the ban on the international sale of ivory products to be lifted. Now, before we get into what happened, what was the basis for the U.S. position?
Well, Peter, let me first say that the proposal that we were facing was to have a limited sale of some stockpiled ivory coming from three southern African countries. So it was not intended to be a lifting of the worldwide ban, only a narrow lifting of the ban as related to some of the stockpiled ivory. Now, we were opposed to the lifting of that ban, however, because of our fear that it might stimulate additional poaching in other countries that had not managed their elephant populations as well.
Now, again, for people who haven't thought about that, the idea would be that if stuff is now legally on the market, then that would inspire poachers to go out and get elephants and kill them off and sell the ivory.
That's correct. In 1989, there was a worldwide ban on international trade in ivory that was implemented under CITES. This would be the first cracking of that ban, a limited narrow exception the countries wanted. So it would be limited only to these three countries and for their stockpiled ivory. But we were concerned that it could have broader implications and effects and could stimulate poaching in other countries that were not as well managed with their herds of elephants.
And Jeanette Hemley, you were there, and the modification of the ban did go in. What happened? What was going on that caused that to happen?
Well, you know, one of the difficulties with this issue is, I mean, it's one of the most complicated we face, I think, in international wildlife conservation, is that there is really no one conservation solution that can apply to all of Africa because of the conservation needs are so different from southern Africa to East Africa to West and Central Africa. And what we saw was something I think that surprised all of us that were there from the international community is there was a growing consensus within Africa to find a change, to get a change to the stalemate that's been going on for the last 6 or 7, well, actually 8 years now since 1989, since the ban first went into place. World Wildlife Fund did not support lifting the ivory trade ban. We supported trying to find a compromise to accommodate some of the unique needs of Southern Africa, of the three countries that, as Don says, they have stockpiles of ivory that they've managed well and that they've been pushing to trade because they need revenues for conservation. We wanted to recognize those specific needs and the concerns of those countries, but going to, so far as to lifting the ban even conditionally was something that we were very wary of, and I think the jury is out right now to see what will happen in terms of impacts on elephants around Africa.
So Don, what was the result of the meeting? What actually came out that is different from where we were before it started?
Well, the vote of the parties, the decision at the CITES conference, was to allow and to authorize within 18 months this limited stockpile sale, provided that various conditions were satisfied.
Well, let's ask the practical question. I'm a tourist. The conditions have allegedly been met so that now I can buy trinkets made out of ivory in Japan, which I guess is where they make them. At the same time, let's suppose that the poachers get going again and using automatic weapons, they start slaughtering weapons as happened before, and are also selling this stuff because now it's in trade. Who's to know the difference? How can it possibly work?
Well, this is actually one of our concerns. In Zimbabwe, for instance, they have a local carving industry. And when you go into the stores in Zimbabwe, you see ivory everywhere for sale. So tourists, say from the United States, who go over to Zimbabwe or Botswana
and see ivory for sale are likely to assume that it's legal. Or if they go to Japan, they might see ivory for sale inside the Japanese market and assume it's legal. If they purchase that ivory and try to get it back into the United States, even though it would be arguably lawful under the CITES proposal coming, say, from Zimbabwe, we still have stricter domestic measures here and would prohibit the importation into this country. So the tourists would end up losing their ivory trinkets here at the state port when they tried to bring it back into this country. And so we're, again, concerned, as you anticipated, that there could be a lot of confusion and a lot of people will be buying ivory again based on the assumption that it's legal worldwide.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. And we're joined now by Jerry Taylor from the Cato Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington. Jerry, welcome to the Environment Show. Good to talk to you again. What is your take on restricting trade in order to preserve wildlife?
Well, I think that promoting trade is the best way to protect wildlife. I mean, this discussion about elephant populations in southern Africa is missing a vital ingredient, and that is that the elephant populations of southern Africa have increased 50% since 1980, while they've declined almost without exception everywhere else on the planet. And it's not by serendipity that this occurred. It's not because of CITES, and it's not because they hired more game wardens to protect elephants. This growth in the elephant herds of southern Africa occurred because they gave communities the right to own, essentially, these elephant resources and to profit by them. Now, the reason we have poaching problems throughout a lot of the parts of the world is that the people on the ground who live with these elephants and with these other endangered species have no way to protect themselves against lost crops, lost life, or whatever. To us, elephants are beautiful, wonderful, majestic beasts. To them, they're marauding, big, giant rats that destroy their livelihoods.
But Jeanette, and so when you've a hunter been out comes there, in
and wants to go hunting, the community is more than willing to help the poacher and not report what happens.
Jeanette,
so when
is that
the community
the way...
is benefited by the trade in elephants, they protect the elephants, and that's why the populations have gone up.
Okay, well, let's hear from Jeanette on that, since I guess you've spent some time out there.
Oh, well, I certainly agree with the principle that we've got to empower local communities to protect their wildlife, and that you can do this often through economic incentives, and sometimes trade can certainly help. I think it's a little bit simplistic to say that that's been the case in even all of southern Africa. So southern Africa has always had a better wildlife management capacity and conservation capacity than much of the rest of Africa. To their benefit, I mean, it's been great to see that they've been able to preserve wildlife where other countries have struggled. But, you know, so I think, you know, you really can't generalize in this sense and say that that's a solution that can apply everywhere. I think we have to look at each country,
Jerry,
on an individual basis.
Let me ask you a question about this. Would you eliminate the use of trade restrictions as a means of wildlife protection? Would you just get out of that business?
Absolutely, with the condition that instead of these endangered species being the communal property of government, they don't do any better job protecting them than they do protecting their own people from violence. But that these communities have property rights over these animals, and then under those restrictions, if those restrictions are considered, then I think international trade in endangered species and their products would actually serve to increase the populations. And in fact, David Cumming of WWF out in Zimbabwe said exactly that. He said the greater proportion of land in Zimbabwe, for example, the land in Zimbabwe, just for listeners who aren't aware of this, devoted to protecting elephants has doubled over the past decade or so. That wouldn't have happened, according to David Cummings of the WWF, if it were not for property rights being established over these elephants and communities benefiting from the elephant trade, and that's why the elephant populations have grown.
Okay, well, one of the things we're going to, and Jerry, thank you for your call, one of the things we're not going to do is decide when wildlife becomes private property. The first case you read in law school, Pearson v. Post, the man who shoots the fox, and then the question is, whose was it and when is it? In any event, a useful and interesting perspective. Let's go to the phones again, and I see that we have a call from Long Island. Jack, you're talking green in the Environment Show.
Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon. I understand you had a question.
I do. I live here on Long Island. There's a number of nautical gift shops that mainly cater to tourists. I note that there are ivory carvings and scrimshaw for sale. And I was wondering if there is this import restriction, how do they acquire these, and are they legal to be sold? And
good question. Let's hear from the Department of Interior on that. Don Barry, scrimshaw on Long Island.
Well, Congress many years ago built in a special exemption for scrimshaw carvings.
And again, quickly, scrimshaw, for folk who don't know what it is?
It has a long nautical tradition. It kind of stemmed from
But what is it?
Whalers. Well, it's ivory. Frequently, whale teeth, which would be carved by whalers during the long months at sea, and then would be sold. And Congress, many years ago, created a special exemption under the Endangered Species Act to allow for continued limited sale of scrimshaw carvings. So the stuff that you would see in those stores is probably legal and consistent with the scrimshaw exemption.
Let me just add to what Donna said. It's important to keep in mind that ivory that was imported into the United States before the ban was imposed in 1989 can also still be sold in most places. So it's only that we could no longer import after 1989.
Correct.
Okay. We've talked about fish a little bit, and we have on the line Mary Cummey, who is the director of the Living Oceans Program of the National Audubon Society. Mary, welcome to Talk It Green. Has CITES been useful at all in protection of marine resources?
Hi, Peter. No, unfortunately, we have not used CITES effectively for the conservation and management of trade in commercially valuable marine species, or fishes, I should say. We do have no commercially valuable fishes listed on CITES, but at the last CITES meeting, there was an attempt to try to raise CITES' attention for these marine fishes and the plight that they are facing.
And what kind of fish particularly are you thinking about?
Well, there were a number of issues that we went to CITES with. These were issues that were supported by the United States government as well as some of the conservation community, including National Audubon, the Ocean Wildlife Campaign, and other conservation groups. And one of the things we wanted to try to achieve was to have the Animals Committee of CITES adopt a report that was produced as a result of a resolution passed in the 1994 CITES meeting on the biology and trade in sharks. And this report was an important thing because it had a lot of recommendations.
So did they adopt it?
Yes, they did adopt it, and they did adopt it with all the recommendations.
So does that
primarily
mean that
address
sharks may be... We may get to the point where sharks are listed as a result of this process?
The report does not make any recommendations on the need for listing, but rather directs CITES and other fisheries organizations like the UN Food and Agriculture Organization to improve the database that we have on shark fisheries and their trade so that we can better manage these shark populations.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking green about endangered species and trade. My guests have been Don Barry from the United States Department of Interior and Jeanette Hemley from the International Policy Division of the World Wildlife Fund. We've been talking green. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We want to hear from you, and I'm your host, Peter Burley.
The main dispute at this year's CITES conference was over animals thousands of miles away from the U.S. For some, that's too far away to worry. But the band Christopher thinks otherwise. Their song, This Is the Earth, appears on a compilation of folk artists from Ohio called More Pickings, A Second Acoustic Harvest.
Save the whales. Save the forest, don't be meek. Oh my God, the earth is burning. A fire burning down the street. Oh my God, the earth is burning. A fire burning down the street. all the fields we own. Help the dying, help the sick. Help the starving, let them eat. Oh my God, the earth. Kept your house in order since you started washing feet. Have you kept your house in order since you started washing feet? See your own face in the mirror. This body is the earth you own. Which body is the earth you own?
This is the Earth by the band Christopher. It appears on a compilation of folk artists from Ohio called More Pickings, A Second Acoustic Harvest. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burling. You'll need a cassette copy of the program to find out if the bugs that eat out the brains of ants are for real. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 394. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. Thomas Lally is producer. And Stephanie Goichman is the associate producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Packard Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.